'cause I'm feeling so blue.
Kim Purcell is an award-winning real estate sales representative working under the Sutton Group Masters Realty Brokerage. Kim was born and raised in Kingston and is into her ninth year of real estate. She has intimate knowledge of the area, which has positively influenced her career as a realtor and led to numerous five-star reviews from clients. If you're looking for a real estate agent in the Kingston area who is trustworthy and will work for your best interests, you're in good hands with Kim. Visit kimpurcell.ca to learn more about Kim's realty services and listings today.
Hi, we're Short Rock to Pluto, and you're listening to CFRC 101.9 FM.
Hi, I'm Caroline.
I'm Sue.
And I'm Carrie.
And you're listening to CFRC 101.9 in Kingston, Ontario.
We're the good lovers.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Let's say Social Security didn't send out their checks this month. My mother-in-law, who's 94, she wouldn't call and complain. She just wouldn't. She thinks something got messed up, and she'll get it next month.
Yeah.
A fraudster always makes the loudest noise, screaming, yelling, and complaining.
Trump's billionaire Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick sparks outrage after suggesting only fraudsters would complain if Social Security checks don't go out on time. As protests over field office closures are taking place nationwide, Trump's pick to head the agency was grilled Tuesday during his Senate confirmation hearing. We'll get response. Then Democratic lawmakers demand Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth and National Security Advisor Michael Waltz resign after they discuss plans to bomb Yemen on an insecure signal group chat. We'll get response from journalist Safaa Al-Ahmed. She's been reporting on Yemen for decades.
As everybody's talking now about the potential security leaks through the Signal chat groups, I think we should also focus more importantly on the civilian casualties as we are now commemorating the 10-year anniversary of the war that's been ongoing in Yemen.
And mass protests continue in Turkey over the arrest and jailing of the mayor of Istanbul, seen as the biggest political rival of Turkey's authoritarian president. More than 1,400 protesters have been arrested in the past week.
By keeping him in prison for 4 days, sending him to court while Turkey was going to the polls for him, and sending him to prison while Turkey was electing him, Erdogan defied not only him, but millions, and attempted to stage a coup.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Gaza, Israeli strikes have killed at least 38 Palestinians over the past 24 hours, including a mother and her five children, the youngest a six-month-old infant. The family was sleeping at the time of the Israeli attack. Meanwhile, an Israeli court has ruled the prominent Palestinian doctor, Hossam Abu Safia, can be held for another 6 months in Israeli prison solely based on secret evidence. Abu Safia served as the director of the Kamal Adwan Hospital in Gaza until he was abducted by Israeli forces in December. In the occupied West Bank, the Palestinian filmmaker Hamdan Balal was released Tuesday from Israeli detention after being brutally attacked on Monday, first by a mob of masked Israeli settlers, then by Israeli soldiers. 3 weeks ago, Balal won an Oscar for co-directing the documentary No Other Land about violent Israeli settlers trying to seize Balal's community in Masafer Yatta. Balal said Israeli soldiers held him overnight blindfolded and handcuffed at a military base. He spoke on Tuesday from a hospital in Hebron where he was receiving treatment.
You know, it's like overnight, it's like many times, but this is first time, okay? They came, the soldiers, with the settlers attacking me and beating me and destroyed me. This is first time. And this is came like first I got it the Oscar also. So and this is it's like let you it's like think why they attacking you like this. It's like hard attack after the Oscar. In the beginning, yes, there is attack, but not like this. The army, they tried to stop the sitter, but this this is the attack. They came, the soldiers, they came attacking me with the sitters.
Visit democracynow.org to see our interview Tuesday with Basaladra, who also co-directed No Other Land with Hamdan Bilal. In other news from the Middle East, an Israeli attack on southern Syria killed at least six people Tuesday. Meanwhile, the United States reportedly launched another 17 strikes on Yemen. The U.S. has been carrying out near-daily strikes on Yemen after Houthi fighters threatened to renew attacks on Red Sea vessels after Israel broke the ceasefire in Gaza. In Washington, D.C., several Democratic lawmakers are calling for Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth and National Security Advisor Michael Waltz to resign after they discussed plans to bomb Yemen on a Signal group chat. Waltz had set up the chat, then accidentally invited Atlantic editor-in-chief Jeffrey Goldberg to join. On Tuesday, President Trump defended Waltz, saying he'd learned his lesson and was a good man. Democratic senators grilled Director of National Intelligence Tulsi Gabbard and CIA Director John Ratcliffe over their involvement in the Signal chat. This is Gabbard responding to a question from Democratic Senator Mark Warner of Virginia.
There was no classified material that was shared in that.
So then if there were no classified in material, share it with the committee. You can't have it both ways. These are important jobs. This is our national security.
Tulsi Gabbard refused to say if she was on the group chat, even though there was a participant with the initials TG. We'll have more on this story later in the broadcast. Gabbard and Ratcliffe were testifying before the Senate in a hearing focused on the U.S. intelligence community's new annual threat assessment. The annual report cited fentanyl and international drug gangs as top threats to the country, but the report now omits climate change as a major threat. This independent Senator Angus King questioning Gabbard.
Who decided climate change should be left out of this report after it's been in the prior 11? Where was that decision?
I gave direction to our team at ODNI to focus on the most extreme and critical national security threats.
Your direction include no comments on climate change?
Senator, as I said, I focused on the most extreme and direct national security threats.
That's not a response to my question.
The Senate hearing was disrupted by a code pink activist who called on the United States to stop funding Israel.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Vice Chairman.
Witness will suspend.
The greatest threat to global security is Israel and the whole world knows it. Stop funding Israel! Stop funding Israel!
A second Code Pink activist, the retired Army colonel, former diplomat Anne Wright, was removed from the hearing and arrested after she stood up to dispute a claim by committee chair Senator Tom Cotton that Code Pink was funded by the Chinese government. Russia and Ukraine have agreed to a naval ceasefire in the Black Sea and a halt to attacks on energy infrastructure after the United States held talks with both countries and Saudi Arabia. But key details still need to be sorted out. Russia said the Black Sea ceasefire will only go into effect after the lifting of international sanctions on Russian agriculture and fertilizer exports. Vice President J.D. Vance has announced in a social media video that he'll join a high-level Trump delegation going to Greenland this week following President Trump's threats to seize the semi-autonomous territory from Denmark.
Speaking for President Trump, we want to reinvigorate the security of the people of Greenland because we think it's important to protecting the security of the entire world. Unfortunately, leaders in both America and in Denmark, I think, ignored Greenland for far too long. That's been bad for Greenland. It's also been bad for the security of the entire world. We think we can take things in a different direction, so I'm going to go check it out.
On the delegation, Vice President Vance will be joining his wife, Second Lady Usha Vance, National Security Advisor Michael Waltz, and Energy Secretary Chris Wright. Greenland and Denmark have accused the United States of putting unacceptable and aggressive pressure on Greenland by sending the uninvited delegation. The American Civil Liberties Union has accused President Trump of despotic, unpresidential behavior after he signed a new executive order targeting the law firm Jenner & Block, the sixth law firm hit with sanctions in recent weeks. The ACLU said, quote, this is part of a larger effort to knock out the pillars of a free society, journalists, universities, the legal profession, and the court. Jenner and Block has been involved in several lawsuits against the Trump administration's policies targeting transgender individuals and asylum seekers. Trump criticized the firm in part for once employing Andrew Weissman, who served as lead prosecutor in Robert Mueller's special counsel's office that investigated Trump's ties to Russia. In related news, The Washington Post reports many big law firms are now refusing to represent critics of Trump, including former Biden officials, out of fear the president may target their firms as well. The AAUP, the American Association of University Professors, and the Middle East Studies Association have sued to block the Trump administration from arresting, detaining, or deporting international students and faculty involved in Palestinian rights protests. One lawyer involved in the case accused the Trump administration of creating a, quote, climate of repression and fear on university campuses across the country, unquote. In related news, a judge has blocked the Trump administration from deporting Anseo Chung, a 21-year-old Columbia University student who participated in pro-Palestine demonstrations on campus. She's a legal permanent resident who's lived in the United States since she was 7 years old. Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem is arriving in El Salvador today, where she'll tour the maximum security megaprison complex detaining hundreds of Venezuelan immigrants and asylum seekers sent by the United States after the Trump administration accused them without evidence of being members of the Tren de Aragua gang. Human rights groups have documented gross violations at the megaprison built by the government of Salvadoran President Nayib Bukele in 2022 after he began enforcing a state of emergency. Protesters took to the streets of San Salvador Tuesday.
We condemn the use of our land as an imperial prison and the attempt to turn our territory into free zones for neo-fascist experimentation. We demand the immediate release of all kidnapped Venezuelan migrants. We demand unrestricted respect for their human rights, due process, and the right to migrate.
On Monday, a U.S. federal judge condemned how the Trump administration expelled the Venezuelans to El Salvador without due process. U.S. Circuit Judge Patricia Millett said, quote, Nazis got better treatment under the Alien Enemies Act than has happened here. She was citing how the Wartime Act was invoked during World War II. In Sudan, at least 54 people were killed Tuesday in a military airstrike on a market in the western village of Tora in North Darfur. Meanwhile, the United Nations is warning South Sudan is on the brink of renewed civil war as fighting escalates between government forces and a rebel militia known as the White Army. In South Korea, at least 24 people have died in the nation's worst ever wildfires. More than 27,000 people have been forced to evacuate due to the blazes that have scorched buildings, factories, and 2 1,000-year-old Buddhist temples. The head of UNAIDS is warning the withdrawal of U.S. foreign aid could lead to 2,000 new HIV infections every day around the world. UNAIDS chief Winnie Byanyima says millions could die if U.S. funding is not restored.
There will be an additional, in the next 4 years, 6.3 million AIDS-related deaths. 6.3 million more in the next 4 years. At the last count, 2023, we had 600,000 deaths globally, AIDS-related deaths. So you're talking of a tenfold increase.
Reuters has published a major expose on one of Elon Musk's top technologists at Doge, the 19-year-old Edward Korestein, whose nickname is Big Balls. Reuters reports beginning in 2022, the then high school student provided technical support to a cybercrime gang that cyber-stalked an FBI agent and trafficked in stolen data. In other Trump news, the Senate Finance Committee has advanced the nomination of Dr. Mehmet Oz to head the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. The former TV host and doctor has a long record of supporting the privatization of Medicare. The Senate also held a confirmation hearing for Mike Huckabee, Trump's pick to be U.S. ambassador to Israel. Huckabee is the former governor of Arkansas and a self-described Christian Zionist who's long supported Israel annexing the occupied West Bank. And President Trump has signed a sweeping new executive order that would require proof of citizenship to register to vote. Voting rights advocates fear the move could disenfranchise tens of millions of voters. Trump's order also aims to prohibit any votes from being counted after Election Day, including absentee ballots sent by mail. The ACLU has threatened to sue to block the order, which the group says marks a significant overreach of executive power. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today looking at how the Social Security Administration is considering drastic new measures that could disrupt benefit payments to millions of Americans. This is according to an internal memo first obtained by the political newsletter Popular Information. Authored earlier this month by Acting Deputy Social Security Administration Commissioner Doris Diaz, the changes proposed in the memo would force millions of customers to file claims in person at a field office rather than over the phone. According to the memo, customers applying for retirement and disability benefits would be required for the first time to verify their identity through an online system. If their identity can't be verified online, they would have to visit a field office in person. A day before the memo was sent, the Washington Post reported Social Security Administration was considering ending telephone service for all claims under pressure from DOGE, the Department of Government Efficiency. Hours after the Washington Post report came out, the agency issued a press release claiming telephone services would not be eliminated. The proposed changes to Social Security come as DOGE is targeting the agency for staff cuts of more than 12%. Meanwhile, Trump's billionaire Commerce Secretary, Howard Lutnick, has sparked outrage after repeatedly suggesting only fraudsters would complain if Social Security checks don't go out on time.
Let's say Social Security didn't send out their checks this month. My mother-in-law, who's 94, she wouldn't call and complain. She just wouldn't. She thinks something got messed up, and she'll get it next month. A fraudster always makes the loudest noise, screaming, yelling, and complaining.
This comes as self-professed DOGE person, former corporate CEO Frank Bisignano, was grilled for more than 2 hours Tuesday by the Senate Finance Committee as confirmation hearing to lead the Social Security Agency. This is one exchange with him and Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren.
Suppose this same 65-year-old calls the helpline to apply for Social Security, but he's told about the new DOGE rule, so he has to go online or in person. He can't drive. He has trouble with the website, so he waits until his niece can get a day off to take him to the local Social Security office. But DOGE closed that office, so they have to drive 2 hours to get to the next closest office. When they get there, there are only two people who are staffing a 50-person line, so he doesn't even make it to the front of the line before the office closes, and he has to come back. Now, let's assume it takes our fellow 3 months to straighten this out, and he misses a total of $5,000 in benefits checks, which, by law, he will never get back. So, Mr. Bisignano, is that a benefit cut?
Well, first of all, Senator,
Is that a benefit cut? My time is limited here. That's an easy question, yes or no? Is it a benefit cut?
I have no intent to have anything like that happen to my wife.
I understand that. Is it a benefit cut?
I'm not sure what to call it. It sounds like a horrible
situation. Is the person getting the $5,000 they were legally entitled to?
That was your scenario. And
so are they getting $5,000 they were legally entitled to?
I don't know.
Social Security provides crucial economic security to more than 70 million people and accounts for over half the income of most people over age 65. One of many protests nationwide, dozens of mostly older adults protested Friday outside a Nashville, Tennessee field office they say is already understaffed with long wait times, is on a list of 47 field offices DOGE plans to close.
We're being told. And everything that they say that they're trying not to do, and one of the things they're saying is that they're not going to attack Social Security, and yet all the actions they're taking is attacking Social Security.
For more, we're joined by two guests. In Chicago, Branko Marchetich is with us, Jacobin staff writer, where his recent piece is headlined, Trump's nominated Social Security head knows how to cut. But we begin in Washington, D.C., with Nancy Altman, president of Social Security Works, chair of the Strengthen Social Security Coalition, the co-author with Eric Kingston of Social Security Works for Everyone, protecting and expanding the insurance Americans love and count on. Altman has spent the last half century working on Social Security. After our interview, she'll be at a rally near the Capitol about defending Social Security. Nancy Altman, welcome to Democracy Now! Let's begin with you before you go off to this rally. It looks like the Commerce Secretary, the billionaire Lutnick, who says that his 94-year-old mother wouldn't complain if she didn't get her Social Security check. She's the mother of a billionaire. Only fraudsters would, is laying the groundwork for people to start to expect, perhaps, that they won't get their checks. Can you explain what's happening?
It's really outrageous. The Donald Trump has a problem. He ran around the country flooding the swing states, saying he would not cut Social Security, Medicare, or Medicaid. But in his first term, he proposed cuts to those programs every single year. Now, those cuts didn't go through. So what's he doing now? He's claiming that there's enormous amount of fraud, which is a lie. There is vanishingly small amounts of fraud. So when he cuts your benefits, they'll be saying he's cutting fraud. He's not cutting the benefits that you have earned.
So talk about what is happening at this point. You have first the threats of phone service. And who are the people who use Social Security and what it means not to be able to speak on the phone? Then you have to go to a satellite office. Perhaps that office is going to be closed or understaffed. You have to wait maybe a month to be able to go in. And the issue is they're closing these offices all over. What's happening to Social Security as we speak?
You know, it's all being done behind closed doors. And what's being done, because we're following it very closely and talking to the people who work at Social Security, is they are destabilizing the program. The agency could wind up collapsing. You've got the DOGE minions, Elon Musk's, you know, 20-year-olds running around Social Security. They've been doing it since this new administration. They've been forcing people out, firing people, hollowing it out. And frighteningly, they have all of our most personal data, and no one knows what they have in store for that.
But, Nancy Altman, this is going to alienate, MAGA Americans who get Social Security. We're talking about tens of millions of Americans, as well as Democrats, progressives, independents. So what is the response to, for example, your organizing? Who's going out and protesting around the country right now at these understaffed, overworked folks at these field offices and the possibility of them closing?
Yes, it's really hard to imagine what they have in mind, what their end game is, other than destroying our Social Security system. As you said, there are over 70 million Americans who receive monthly benefits that they have earned. They tend to be, they are seniors, people with disabilities, the nation's largest children's program. Many of them have mobility issues. If they can't use the phone, they really are excluded from getting those benefits. It's really an outrage. And we're trying to get the word out. And I'm so appreciative that you're having this segment because it's really important. I don't want to scare people because people are dependent on those benefits to pay their rent, to pay their food. And I don't want to scare people, but I do want people alerted. Everyone should be rising up and saying, hands off Social Security.
I want to go to Democratic Senator Ron Wyden, the top-ranking Democrat on the Senate Finance Committee, grilling Frank Bisignano at his confirmation hearing to head the Social Security Administration. Wyden citing a tip from a whistleblower and asking Bisignano if he was bringing on DOGE team members who could access Social Security beneficiaries' personal information.
So, according to the whistleblower, you personally intervened to get key DOGE officials installed at the agency who have masterminded this shipwreck that we're dealing today. Did you talk to anyone at Social Security about these changes?
I have never talked to Mr. Dudek. I have talked to Mike Russo, and I've said that to your staff when they asked me. I know Mike Russo. He was the CIO of Shift 4, and he was the CIO at Oracle for Mark Hurd. And I know him for 20 years. I don't know him as a DOGE person. I know him as a CIO.
So, Nancy Altman, president of Social Security Works, can you respond to what the nominated head of Social Security Administration is saying, Frank Bisignano?
He is bobbing and weaving. Here's the truth. He is described himself as a DOGE guy. Now, that what that means is, although it's the government of efficiency, it's bringing in inefficiency, it's bringing in waste, and it's opening the possibility of massive fraud through identity theft and so forth. He, from the very beginning, has been very aggressive. He's still a private citizen. He's been nominated. He has no role in the government, but he has been all over the Social Security Administration. He's been working hand in glove with Elon Musk to hollow out the agency and to make these changes where you can't, where the no longer can change your routing number and you can't finish your claims on by phone. You have to go into field offices, which of course they're trying to terminate all the field offices. He is really a part of what is going on and is bobbing and weaving so he can get confirmed.
I want to bring in Branko Marcetic into this conversation, the Jacobin staff writer. Your recent piece, Branko, is Trump's nominated Social Security head knows how to cut. Tell us who he is.
Yeah, Bisignano was the CEO of Pfizer from 2020 to now. Before that, he was the CEO of a different payment processing company, First Data. It was a credit card payment processor. I think people, and they think, brought on because he has experience in terms of payments, large amounts of payments every single day, every second being processed. Therefore, he'll be good for something like the Social Security Administration, where that is so much of the responsibility. But the thing about Bisignano is that his record as CEO of these companies is relevant in another way. He was responsible for massive cuts to staff levels, to officers, to benefits for workers at these companies. Basically, very much the same kind of thing that we've been seeing DOGE doing at the Social Security Administration already. So anyone who was thinking that if Bisignano is going to be brought in as the commissioner of the Social Security Administration, that there was going to be a change in direction from what we've seen, the Trump administration was going to make good on the president's promises to leave Social Security untouched, I think should be very worried by his appointment.
If you could talk about Bisignano's corporate time as CEO of Fiserv. You write, Fiserv's Glassdoor reviews are riddled with bitter personal animus to Bisignano. specifically. The decision-making in the company has been extremely erratic since Frank Bisignano took over as CEO. Another one, once Frank took over, it became a horrible place to work for. Another said Frank and his squad, not the greatest TBH, to be honest. Another one, the CEO is a micromanager, only cares about the stock price. Another, replace Frank with a leader who listens. Another, CEO could care less about employees. They're all a widget and an expense to him. Mr. Scrooge at his finest, concluded one. And another said, Frank, please go buy an island and move there, never to return. Talk about the significance of this and then how it fits in, Branko, to being the head of the Social Security Administration.
I mean, there is a deep, deep dislike, to put it mildly, for Bisignano among the workers of Fiserv. I mean, what comes up in these Glassdoor reviews, I would recommend people go and look at them. There's thousands upon thousands, most of them well before anyone knew that he was going to get nominated for Trump's administration. And they all paint a pretty similar picture. Not only do they think that Bisignano is a terrible CEO, someone who has done all these massive cuts so that he can just pour billions of dollars of profit back into stock buybacks. And by the way, he's a massive shareholder in Fiserv and actually sold $25 million worth of shares. So he is the one profiting directly from this. But they also talk about the kind of effect that these cuts have had on them as workers, as people trying to make Fiserv, you know, do what it's meant to. And what they say is that experienced people, some of the most capable workers, have either been fired because they didn't want to relocate when offices were closed and consolidated in places that were advantageous for tax incentives, or they left because they found that the working was so inflexible and so inconvenient that they may as well just go somewhere else. And so you have this massive brain drain from Fiserv, while at the same time people complained about their working conditions getting worse, their benefits being cut. They talked about having to take on a much bigger workload and having to make that work, even though they had now a far smaller staff. All of that is a pretty grim portent, I would say. If this is what Bisignano is being brought into the Social Security Administration to do, which I think he is, it suggests that the people who are left, who are not fired from this massive cost-cutting operation by Doge, are going to be left trying to scramble and keep their heads above water, despite the fact that they have far less capability to do so. And the people that are going to be hurt by it are the actual Social Security beneficiaries.
I want to thank you both for being with us, but ask Branko to stay with us for our next segment. Branko Marcetic is a Jacobin staff writer. We'll link to your piece. And Nancy Altman is president of Social Security Works. She's going off to a rally to preserve Social Security. Next up, Democratic lawmakers demand Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth and National Security Advisor Michael Waltz resign after they discuss plans to bomb Yemen in an unsecure Signal group chat and included a journalist in that chat. Stay with us.
Me and Loretta, we don't talk much now. Factory. What'll I tell him if he asks what's new?
Joan Baez singing the classic John Prine song. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Mimi Goodman. Several Democratic lawmakers are calling for Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth and National Security Advisor Mike Waltz to resign after they discussed plans to bomb Yemen on a Signal group chat. Waltz had set up the chat, which also included Vice President J.D. Vance, and accidentally, apparently, invited the Atlantic magazine editor-in-chief, Jeffrey Goldberg, to join. On Tuesday, President Trump downplayed the severity of the lapse, saying it, quote, turned out not to be a serious one. Trump also defended Waltz, saying he'd learned his lesson and was a good man. In the Signal chat, Vice President Vance initially argued against the strikes on Yemen, saying, quote, 3% of U.S. trade runs through the Suez, 40% of European trade does. Vance also said, I'm not sure the president is aware how inconsistent this is with his message on Europe right now. There's a further risk that we see a moderate to severe spike in oil prices. I'm willing to support the consensus of the team and keep these concerns to myself. But there's a strong argument for delaying this a month, doing the messaging work on why this matters, seeing where the economy is, etc. In response to the first wave of bombings, Waltz posts emojis of a fist, an American flag, and fire. Over 50 Yemenis were killed during those U.S. strikes in Yemen, including children. Democratic senators grilled Director of National Intelligence Tulsi Gabbard, CIA Director John Ratcliffe over their involvement in the Signal chat. This is Gabbard responding to a question from Democratic Senator Mark Warner of Virginia.
There was no classified material that was shared in that
Signal chat. So then if there was no classified material, share it with the committee. You can't have it both ways. These are important jobs. This is our national security.
The director of national intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, refused to say if she was on the group chat, even though there was a participant with the initials TG. National security experts say using Signal to share classified information likely violates the Espionage Act and federal records law. Meanwhile, Congressmember Rashida Tlaib said on social media, quote, more heat for using a group chat than for the bombing itself. We're joined now by two guests. We're going to begin with Safa Al-Ahmed. She's a journalist who's been reporting on Yemen since 2010, award-winning director of the frontline documentaries Yemen Under Siege and The Fight for Yemen. Also with us still, Branko Marcetic, a Jacobin staff writer. Safa, let's begin with you. Today is a very significant day.
Yes, it is. Sadly, it's the 10-year anniversary of the Saudi-led war on Yemen, which the U.S. has been backing for these 10 years. And so it's ironic to me to see messages from Vance saying we have to do more messaging about who the Houthis are when we have, as Americans, been involved in this war for so long.
The U.S.-backed Saudi-led bombing of Yemen. Now, yeah. In these attacks on March 15th, and we don't see any mention of this, almost none in the corporate media is talking Correct. About the actual attacks. What, something like 53 Yemenis were killed? Who
yes.
were they?
So we don't have specific numbers yet of how many civilians among them. But as you saw, the Pentagon briefing, that they denied there were any proof of any civilians killed, even though factually there were children. Killed, but this is a track record of most U.S. administrations of denying that there were any civilian casualties until you actually go on the ground and you prove that. And I was there the last time the Trump administration had a U.S. raids, and they had killed civilians, but the Pentagon refuses to accept or acknowledge the responsibility for those killings.
So Vance's response is very interesting. First of all, it's a serious put down of yeah. the president. He's saying, I don't think he understands what's going on. But he also says he was against the bombing because why are we doing Europe's work? He basically
yeah.
said, this
and
is only 3% of our trade. It's 40% of Europe's trade. Let's do some messaging for a month to explain why we're going against our own philosophy of supporting and not supporting Europe.
Yeah, correct. I mean, but this goes to how the United States has not taken responsibility, really. They want double standards here. They want to bomb Yemen, regardless of whether they're attacking the Houthis or they're claiming to attack ISIS and al-Qaeda. There, regardless of that, they continue to change the targets of who they are killing in Yemen. But regardless of that, they are killing Yemenis with no recourse for the Yemenis themselves. So whether it's the interest of Europeans or the Americans, it's been going on in Yemen for so long now with zero accountability. There's over, as per the UN, over 300,000 people have been killed during this war. So
explain why the U.S. is attacking Yemen now.
Well, they're now attacking Yemen because the Houthis are attacking ships that are going through the Red Sea through Bab al-Mandeb, which is the strait that the Houthis currently have access to and control. And the Houthis are saying that they're doing this in support of the Palestinian people and the people in Gaza specifically, because they said if you lift the siege on Gaza and you let the aid in, then we will stop the attacks. And so preemptively, the United States, this specific time, this March, they started doing that because the Houthis were saying we're going to start again, because the Israelis had completely stopped all aid coming into Gaza.
I wanted to bring Branko Marcetic into this conversation. Republicans were even suggesting that Jeffrey Goldberg, the editor-in-chief of The Atlantic, who was so shocked that he was included in this chat, it was a signal chat, actually thought it was some kind of disinformation campaign, did not think it was real, had gotten the invite a few days before from the National Security Advisor, from Mike Waltz. But then on that Saturday morning, when he was sitting in a parking lot doing some shopping, he saw them say the bombing, Hegseth, is about to begin. And sure enough, 2 hours later, all over Twitter, all over X, the bombing had begun. And he then came to understand that this was for real. Now the Republicans are trying to suggest, even as they attack him as a terrible journalist, that he somehow hacked into this. But if he was able to hack into this signal chat, who else was able to? What other country was able to, Branko?
Well, yeah, I mean, Steve Witkoff, who was Trump's envoy, who was in Russia at the time, and he was on the group chat. So you have to think, if Jeffrey Goldberg was able to hack it, which I don't think is what happened, then surely the Russian government has probably got its hands on their communications as well. I mean, I think that this excuse, the idea that Goldberg hacked into it, is a very obvious way to shove blame away from, you know, someone like Mike Waltz, who, you know, the uncomfortable question for Waltz here is, why is it that he had Jeffrey Goldberg's number in his phone so that he mistakenly added him to this chat, when Jeffrey Goldberg is someone who has written many critical stories about Trump, a journalist that Trump has quite a vendetta against. And also, by the way, Jeffrey Goldberg is someone who very prominently sold false information that led to the Iraq War. So the question is, you know, beyond everything else that we're talking about, is there a level of discord here within Trump's team that is being exposed, that they are now trying to kind of cover up?
What do you think, Safa, is most important for people to understand at this point?
I mean, I think this is not the first time that such a leak has happened. In my last film, when I was in Yemen, the special ops team that had landed in a tiny little town of Adlan, they had left a medical backpack with the true full names of the special ops soldiers that were there in the attack, plus two more names, just one name. And we were wondering, we asked the Pentagon, who are these who are these two names? And they were classified dog names that they had brought in with the team, right? And the list of names, 22 names, were laminated. And so not only did they bring it in, it was laminated, it had full names. And so the Trump administration at that time didn't even take responsibility for that or admit that it was wrong. And I would argue that is even more dangerous when you're saying that you have gone into a town to attack Al-Qaeda compound. And so, the Atlantic journalists showed a lot of restraint by not publishing or saying more when he was added to the tip, but that they were very lucky. I mean, it could have been somebody else. I mean, it's really astounding the level of insecurity in these texts.
And we just have 10 seconds, but Branko, signal chat is time to disappear. So, of course, the National Archive won't have a record of this planned attack and what was going into it, which was so clearly delineated in the texting of the Defense Secretary, Hegseth. 15 seconds.
Yeah, I mean, I would just remind people that, that what we saw in those chats is that there was actually no legal rationale under the Constitution for doing these strikes. The rationale was deterrence and shipping, protecting shipping. That is not in the Constitution that allows the president to unilaterally launch a war to just for this nebulous idea of protecting international shipping. Only Congress is actually able to declare war.
Branko Marcicic, Jacobin staff writer, and Safa Al Ahmed, journalist who has been reporting on Yemen since 2010. When we come back, we look at the mass protests and arrests in Turkey. Back in 20 seconds.
Where there were deserts, I saw fountains, and like cream, the waters rise. We strolled, and there together, we none to laugh or criticize. Well, the leopard and the lamb lay together, but truly bound. Well, I was hoping, in my hoping, to recall.
People of the power, Patti Smith at Democracy Now!'s 20th anniversary celebration, standing with Michael Stipe. She will be celebrated tonight at Carnegie Hall, and Michael will be one of those singing. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show in Turkey, where protesters took to the streets for a seventh consecutive night, defying a ban following the jailing of the Istanbul mayor, Ekrem İmamoğlu, who's seen as the biggest political rival to Turkey's authoritarian president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, ahead of the 2028 presidential election. Since protests broke out, Turkish authorities have detained more than 1,400 people, including students and journalists. Democracy Now! Spoke to Turkish political scientist Ezgi Başaran, an associate faculty member at Oxford University. I began by asking her about the Istanbul mayor's significance, the arrest in Turkish politics since being elected mayor.
Ekrem İmamoğlu won the election. He became the mayor of Istanbul in a landmark victory in 2019 and took Istanbul from the grips of the ruling party, first time ever. As you might remember, Erdogan's rise to power started with the Istanbul mayorship. And he once said that one who rules Istanbul rules Turkey. So Istanbul has always his most precious gift. And losing Istanbul to Ekrem İmamoğlu in 2019 made him extremely angry. That's why the first election was annulled by, you know, charges of irregularities. But it angered many people, so a rerun happened, and then Ekrem İmamoğlu won with a bigger margin. But a relentless, protracted, legal warfare happened. And, he's been accused by calling the Supreme Electoral Council fools. The council that annulled the first vote, and so he actually the court sentenced him to over 2 years, which would lead into a political ban, but it's pending appeal. And then several terror charges has been thrown at him since 2021. And this year, the last year, autumn, 2024 autumn, things have escalated. Pro-government talking heads started saying that Ekrem İmamoğlu is corrupt to its core, and there's going to be this really patriotic, heroic prosecutor who's going to take him down and make him pay. And suddenly, people around Ekrem İmamoğlu, this is happening like 2 weeks ago, campaign staff, contractors, media consultants, suddenly they were slapped with travel bans. And then came the absurdity. Beginning of last week, Ekrem İmamoğlu's 35-year-old university diploma was cancelled on bureaucratic grounds, which would disqualify him to run against Erdogan in a presidential campaign.
Because you have to be a college graduate to run for president?
Exactly. Which is ironic. And I think this is kind of a now in the playbook of the authoritarians, there's gaslighting, because, you know, there is also a enigma about Erdogan himself, Erdogan's own diploma. I mean, we have never seen his diploma, and many people think that he only has a two-year in-between diploma, not a university diploma. So now he's accused of Ekrem İmamoğlu not having a diploma. 2 days later, he's arrested. A 121-page of interrogation report was published, leaked, whatever you say. I read it, and the questions, I mean, the allegations are based on three anonymous witnesses, no concrete evidence, no, prosecutor filing, showing any, you know, financial crime documents or anything, just rumors through these witnesses. And now Ekrem İmamoğlu is both accused of running an organized crime, being a leader of an organized crime that, you know, a financial crime, and also a simultaneous investigation is also underway, that he's also supporting the outlawed Kurdish militant group, PKK.
So let me go to that issue. Turkish President Tayyip Erdogan has accused the opposition CHP party of fueling terrorism, referring to the massive protests that have erupted since the arrest and detention of the Istanbul mayor last week. This is the president.
The opposition, the Republican People's Party, attempted to provoke our nation over this corruption operation. They've been doing everything they can for 4 days to disturb the peace of the nation and polarize our people, from insulting anyone they encounter to attacking our police officers who are only doing their jobs, from intimidating our members of the judiciary who are investigating corruption reports to suppressing the national will with street terrorism. They have done it all.
Your response to this, Ezgi Başaran, to the president of Turkey?
I really don't want to be in that position to respond to him, but I will try. I mean, it is terrifying to be a person with integrity and intellect in Turkey, because, look, we're seeing the arbitrariness, the breakdown of seriousness in the judicial system. We are seeing a system where hearsay is enough to arrest a politician who won re-election just a year ago with 4.5 million votes, 51% of Istanbul's electorate. And, you know, if that happens to Ekrem İmamoğlu, what could happen to anyone else who voiced dissent or challenge the status quo? And but same thing, this is terrifying, yes, but also the fear of the wall of fear that we say in Turkey has cracked, that kept people in. And, you know, students, octogenarians, they all fled to the streets to ask for, to protest what has happened, because everyone knows that this is politically motivated, and that Erdogan is scared that he's not going to win against Ekrem İmamoğlu. So the political motives are just very conspicuous. But people are on the street. The mottos are really sweet. The youth are just finding all kinds of ways of presenting their contentions. But the Turkish government is what is called a high capacity undemocratic state in political science parlance, which means strong on repression, weak on rights. So they are doing what they know they know best: water cannons, tear gas, plastic bullets, and like you said at the beginning, 1,000 are being detained, and we just learned just now that more than 250 are arrested. And he's not going to back down, Erdogan. because that would be detrimental to his rule. I mean, he's just going to ramp up its repression of the streets and this legal warfare that would, what we hear, would, you know, encompass more students, journalists, politicians, businessmen, academics, and artists, actually, in the coming weeks.
And can you talk about the detention of journalists, the arrests? And we talked about 1,100 people arrested so far. Also, 10 journalists at least detained, both in Istanbul and Izmir. One of the journalists detained covering the protest outside Istanbul's city hall. 9 others detained in dawn raids. And what this means for press freedom in Turkey.
Amy, there's no press freedom in Turkey. I mean, whatever left of, you know, several news outlets who are trying very hard to financially, you know, survive is has also, you know, becoming moot in a way because, I mean, news is costly and you can end up in jail, but also you can't really survive, you know, do your work or do your reporting. And my colleagues are still trying to do their best. But, you know, every day there's something, a terrorism charge or insulting, you know, the nationals, I mean, a you know, public official or, you know, jeopardizing national security are those, you know, charges that thrown at my colleagues who end up in jail, at least lose their job or lose their license to, you know, operate as journalists. Those 11 journalists were just doing their jobs. But, you know, at the peak of the protest, while we were waiting the decision of the courts, all of a sudden the board of, you know, broadcasting in Turkey just all of a sudden tweeted that if they continue to go live from the field from, you know, just, you know, if you continue anyone continuing the live stream of the protest will lose their license. And just like that, we lost the live stream from, you know, Saraçhane or Taksim from Istanbul. So this is the environment that Turkish media is operating.
The talk about voices being shut out. I wanted to ask you about the richest man in the world, about Elon Musk and his social media platform X, which has reportedly suspended hundreds of accounts belonging to opposition activists and others in Turkey. Can you talk about the significance of this?
I mean, the like I said, the gaslighting part is just tremendous. They're actually seriously playing with our nerves at some point. I mean, we know that, I mean, Elon Musk is detested among liberals and pro-democracy people in Turkey because of his sleazy meetings with Erdogan. And it's covert or overt negotiations in terms of, you know, giving names or providing data of certain individuals that Turkish intelligence or any Turkish state official asked for. So, but nobody's surprised how, Elon Musk operated because they are in such a good relationship. And Musk has always something in the game, you know. Maybe he's just thinking of coming and having a Starlink over Turkey. So he doesn't have any principle, and that's why he gets along well with a very pragmatic, powerful leader like Erdogan.
And to end by asking you, as you cover world politics from Oxford in the UK, your thoughts on what you see across the pond here in the United States, your reflections over the past 2 months, and do you see similarities with what's happening in Turkey?
Shall I say the truth?
Please.
Okay, so I think what allowed Erdogan to do what he did was the environment, the climate of impunity. There's a war in Europe. Turkey's military might be needed. Erdogan could play a role in EU's new defense plans. He has drones. He has troops. The geography is behind him. Netanyahu just broke another ceasefire. He kills and kills. There's no impunity. I mean, there's no impunity. He's not a political pariah. And Trump dismantled America's democracy. He keeps doing that every day. He is mimicking Erdogan's playbook. Like, only the ones that really watched Turkey in the last decade and a half would realize that it took more than a decade to dismantle a Turkish institution to capture the state. But, Trump is doing the same. And it is that public now on the streets in Turkey is our only hope.
Turkish political scientist Ezgi Başaran, associate faculty member at Oxford University, speaking to us from there. Her Substack is Angle, Anchor, and Voice. We'll link to the full interview on what's happening in Turkey today at democracynow.org. As we conclude our show, a very happy birthday to Nermin Sheikh, our